This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, WGCU's John Davis sits down with Nikki Fried. She's the Democratic candidate for Florida Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Also later this hour, the PBS NewsHour hosted special coverage from Florida, looking into topics like President Trump's strategy in our state and how voters are weighing environmental issues like red tide and blue-green algae blooms. We're going to listen in on several of those segments. But first, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum will be in Southwest Florida today for campaign stops in Punta Gorda at 4 p.m. and Fort Myers at 5 o'clock. The Democratic candidate for Florida governor is on a 30-county bus tour as his campaign pushes toward the general election next Tuesday. We had a chance to speak with Mayor Gillum on Saturday afternoon. Let's hear that conversation now. You've spent the days since the last debate on the road on your bus tour. I want to know what you're seeing. Anything different in the mood or anything since pre-debate?
Oh, my gosh. The energy is incredible out here. We have done, I think, 5 rallies today. We did 4 rallies yesterday. Incredible turnout, incredible energy. I understand why the President Trump is afraid of a tsunami in Florida. A blue tsunami in Florida. I honestly believe that we are going to surprise a lot of people come November 6th with the number of people who will have turned out to participate in this election and the kind of candidates that are going to prevail. I'm extremely excited about the race and very excited about the next several days of the bus tour.
It's interesting that you mentioned President Donald Trump. You know, he's going to be coming down here to Southwest Florida on Wednesday. And I understand you're also planning on making a stop down here in Charlotte County and Lee County on Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah, we're coming. Listen, we said we are going to campaign everywhere. There is no part of this state that is off limits to our campaign. We've already campaigned in Putnam County, in Bay County, in Jackson County. We went down to Flagler County. We were in Sarasota, Manatee County earlier today. Did rallies in the Newton area. There's no part of the state that's off limits. I'm so sick of Democrats running for governor and treating it as if it's the Electoral College. You don't win one county and lose another. Win one and lose another. You win by winning one more vote. And we believe that that one more vote may come from anywhere throughout the length and the breadth of this state. And so we're prepared to go there, prepared to share our vision, and prepared to compete for every single vote that we can get. So, you know, good luck to the president. The president is going to areas that he believes are reliably Republican. And while they do that, we're going to go to areas that are reliably Floridian. And based off of that, we believe we're going to win.
So, you know, I've talked to people on both sides of the political spectrum, and there are obviously, as you may have alluded to there, a lot of people on the right in our area. So I wanted to have you address a couple of things that come up every time you talk with somebody that is on the right. One of the biggest things that comes up is a tax plan. There are people who were saying that you want to raise taxes by 40% on corporations. Can you clarify some of those things for us?
Yes, indeed. So let me first say I have no plan and no interest in instituting a state income tax. It's one of the great, you know, selling points of the state of Florida. My opponent and their campaign has put out text messages suggesting that I do. I don't. Under my plan, what we have said is that we're going to increase the corporate tax rate by 2.5%, and we're doing it in order to pay teachers a higher wage. Right now in the state of Florida, teachers are paid the 45th lowest average salary out of all 50 states. In the state of Florida, only 3% of companies pay the corporate tax rate, 3%. 97% of businesses pay no corporate taxes at all. We are not proposing any change to that. That 3% of companies that do pay the corporate tax rate in Florida are the wealthiest corporations that exist in this state. And under the Trump tax realignment, that 3% of corporations walked away with $6.3 billion. Continuing, $6.3 billion. So what we've said is that they can keep $5.3 billion. We just want a billion of that to come into this state's education system so that we can train their future workforce. It is, in my opinion, a win-win. Florida cannot be a leading economy when we are ranked 40th out of 50th in public education.
So you
cannot be a leading economy in that way.
So your tax plan is really just 2.5, you said?
2.5 points. That's exactly right.
2.5%. That's different from the 40% that I'm hearing people mutter about. So 2.5%, and that's on the larger corporations.
It's only three. A lot of people assume that every business in the state pays the corporate tax rate. They don't. Florida does not assess corporate taxes on LLCs or S-Corps. The overwhelming majority of businesses and almost all small businesses in the state are organized as S-Corps or LLCs, and they don't pay corporate taxes at all. We're talking about multilateral and multinational corporations. Again, these are the wealthiest companies in the state, and only 3% of companies in the state pay the corporate tax rate. And even under our tax plan, they will pay less under a Gillum administration than they have paid under 8 years of a Scott administration. So these are scare tactics intended to make people think that we're just completely out of line and out of step with where the people are. Well, look, everyday people in our state are already paying their fair share. They're paying it in the sales tax. They're contributing through consumption taxes. And all we're saying is that if we're going to be able to have the revenue we need to build the future economy of this state, we have got to invest in public education, because too many companies are deciding that they can't locate in the state of Florida because Florida cannot produce the educated talent that they need to fill the jobs that they can create. We're the third largest state in America. That should not be our problem. Under a Gillum administration, we're going to ensure that that is not our problem.
So when you come down to Southwest Florida, you're going to hear a lot about the environment. A lot of the concerns that we have in this part of the state are beyond the scope of one state government and what they can do. That we have climate change, sea level rise. But as far as what we allow to enter our waterways, what do you see as the state's role in limiting that?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, we've got to force the Department of Environmental Protection to do their job. We have literally handed over the reins of environmental protection to some of the biggest polluters in the state. They are required to abide by these best practice documents that they submit to the Department of Agriculture. And based off those best practice documents, which don't include timelines around when they're actually going to get to doing that work to reduce the number of nitrates going into groundwater, that they're able to continue to operate some of the biggest polluting operations. But I'll tell you, the issues around our environment are manifold. They're not just what we do with agriculture. Agriculture is a part of it, and we've got to hold those folks responsible for their contributions. But we also have to deal with such rapid growth north of Lake Okeechobee. We've got thousands of miles of impervious surface that's being added that's causing nitrates to flow from our streets and from impervious into groundwater, and then it makes its way into Lake Okeechobee. And when those discharges happen, we get the kind of blue-green algae that we're experiencing now. We know as an impact of global climate change and sea level rise that we're dealing with, you know, more red tide and more frequent red tide than we've ever seen before. So what people ought to know is that when they elect me governor, they're going to have a governor who believes in science. I'm going to assemble the best scientists, the best biologists, the best marine biologists to help us come up with a comprehensive plan to deal with short-term, medium-term, and long-term solutions to dealing with this crisis. We didn't get here overnight. We're not going to get out of here overnight. But there's some steps that we can take to help address this issue, reduce the level of nitrates, make sure that we start to capture pollutants on site rather than allowing it to flow downstream. And then obviously dealing with the impact on our estuary. And writ large, we're going to have a much more comprehensive plan around how we do some carbon extraction from the environment. And there are already innovative technologies that are out there that Florida needs to experiment with as a way to help protect our climate from the disastrous impacts of climate change and sea level rise.
One of the things that's been interesting throughout the campaign is how you've straddled the rural versus coastal. Big corporate ag is sort of a bad word out on the coast, but out and around Lake Okeechobee, that's their livelihood. How can a potential governor approach the agricultural industries in order to make a change that's not going to severely impact the people for whom it is their livelihood?
Well, that's true. And part of what I said about make sure we maintain, you know, a new deal for those communities that will be most directly impacted when we purchase up land from Sugar and restore the southern flow of water from Lake O into the Everglades is that those folks need a new deal. How do we train and retrain, making folks ready for this new economy? We don't have a job gap in this country. We have a skills gap. This may be an opportunity in those areas to experiment with the kind of apprenticeship and the kind of skill-based training that we know we need in order to help power the future.
And that could be... And that could also end up being some sort of a pilot for rural communities across the country.
You're on it. That's exactly right. And I know you've got another question, and I'm happy to answer it. But on this point, because it's an important one, of the 67 counties in the state of Florida, 36 of those counties say that they are economically worse off today than they were in 2007. And so we've got to get our hands around how it is that we create inducements and incentives for rural economies, more suburban areas, to continue to grow and benefit from some economic opportunity of this state, so they're not all having to move to urbanized areas in order to get access to work.
I wanted to, before we run out of time, I know you're on a limited time budget because this is, after all, the last stretch. The events that unfolded over the past week have been unnerving, to say the very least. There was a serial bomber. He mentioned you many times in social media before he was apprehended. Then we had a mass shooting at a synagogue by a person alleged to be a neo-Nazi extremist type. What can a politician do to try to not incite these kinds of people from angry words to angry actions?
Yeah, no, it's an important and a very timely question. First of all of our hearts and prayers continue to go out to those families in Pittsburgh who were impacted by that horribly inspired hate shooting, mass killing that snuffed out the lives of so many loved ones. Listen, elected officials and leaders have a responsibility to lead. We have a responsibility to set a more proper discourse in the body politic. The president, frankly, beginning with the president of the United States, who can no longer give cover, who can no longer create a moral equivalency against people who are motivated by hate based off of someone's faith, their religion, or their background, the color of their skin, the language that they may speak. And it is true that he is unfortunately given that kind of cover, which I think has created the environment where people are no longer able to just disagree over policy, disagree over public opinion. Instead, they're taking those disagreements and by extension are now taken to violence as a way to solve political differences. That is unacceptable. That is not the American way. And quite frankly, in my campaign, we tried to talk about the public policy discourse. We tried to ratchet down what could otherwise be very dangerous rhetoric. I call it out when I see it. And it's important that all of us do that in order to return a status quo in this country where people can disagree and disagree passionately without resulting to deadly violence. It's extreme. It's unnecessary. And we have to bring that kind of violence to heel.
All right, Andrew Gillum, I want to tell you again, thank you so much for the time that you took out of your extremely busy schedule to talk with us. Safe travels.
It's my treat. I wish you all well, and I'm looking forward to visiting the region again soon.
That was Tallahassee Mayor and Democratic candidate for Florida Governor Andrew Gillum. We spoke with him on Saturday, October 27th. We have extended an invitation to his Republican opponent, Ron DeSantis, but we have not heard back from his campaign. We're going to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll hear John Davis's recent conversation with Nikki Fried. She's the Democratic candidate for Florida Commissioner of Agriculture. She faces Republican Matt Caldwell during next Tuesday's general election. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. With the November midterm election now less than a week away, our series of interviews with the Republican and Democratic nominees for public office continues now in a conversation with Democratic candidate Nikki Fried, who's vying to become the state's next Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Fried is an attorney and lifelong Floridian who previously headed the felony division of the Alachua County Public Defender's Office. In the private sector, she's also worked on behalf of Florida homeowners facing foreclosure during the housing crisis a decade ago. In more recent years, Fried has worked as a lobbyist on behalf of the medical marijuana industry here in Florida. Fried's campaign marks her first attempt at holding public office, and she's the first woman from either major party to receive a nomination for the Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services office's position. I recently caught up with Fried in a conversation about her background and qualifications and the priorities on her campaign platform, including addressing water quality and harmful algal blooms, helping citrus and other Florida growers, implementation of the state's medical marijuana industry, developing a hemp industry in Florida, regulation of firearms, and cracking down on fraudsters that prey on vulnerable residents. Let's hear that conversation now. Before we get into issues and your campaign priorities, I wanted to talk a little about your background. You're a lifelong Floridian raised in the Miami area, and as an attorney working for the Alachua County Public Defender's Office, heading the felony division, and then in private practice working with homeowners facing foreclosure during that terrible housing crisis. Tell me about what you gained through that work experience and how you think that's going to help you lead the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services.
Sure. You know, as an attorney, we're taught to be advocates, to be fierce fighters for the things that we believe in and we're fighting for. So I got to have, you know, firsthand experience at the public defender's office overseeing a caseload of 1,500 different clients. So I and about four different attorneys that were underneath me. So I gained leadership skills, case management skills, as well as seeing firsthand all the injustices and the fallacies in our criminal justice system, and so know kind of where we need to go on some criminal justice reform, and that helps as far as a member of the clemency board as a cabinet member. And then when I was down in South Florida fighting, you know, against the big banks, knowing, you know, some of the corporate, you know, the corruption that was happening and all of the fraud on our consumers. You know, basically a lot of these mortgage companies and a lot of the banks went out of their way to deceive the public about what was, you know, in their best interest. And so seeing how that was injustice. And so I've been a fierce fighter for the public and for the taxpayers for my entire legal career. And so when I get to, you know, be in a position where I can make a difference and make a change, I know that all of my experience and all of my background will help me move forward on that.
And you're no stranger to politics, of course, having worked as a lobbyist in Tallahassee for the last several years. And when you came to Fort Myers for an event in late September, you had said, quote, "I know enough to be dangerous. I know where the bodies are buried when it comes to policy and where it comes to the budgeting process. And so I know enough to know how to fix it." And I was hoping you could expound on what you meant by that quote, particularly, you know, figuratively knowing where the bodies are buried.
Yeah, you know, having been in Tallahassee and seeing, you know, kind of how the sausage is made, you know, knowing the budget process and how last-minute amendments get, you know, thrown onto pieces of legislation, knowing how, you know, certain line items go into the budget at the last minute, and really that's kind of what got me to run for office, because I was so frustrated with all of those happenings. I used to say, you know, God forbid, you know, citizens of our state came up to Tallahassee the last 2 weeks, they would be disgusted by the legislative process. And so somebody like me who knows that from the, you know, from an outside perspective as being, you know, a government consultant and lobbyist, you know, I know how to fix it. I know where all of those things come into play and make sure that there's transparency in the process. I'd be able to go in and kind of fix how the budgets get made and making sure that the priorities and the budget are what is best for the state of Florida and not necessarily the special interest. So that's kind of what I meant, because I know the other side of it and know how I have felt fighting for good causes and for the right side of the issues, and seeing how legislation at the very last minute, like speech renourishment issues, fighting for that in the last minute, those bills being killed and because of politics. And I was working on a bill last year to protect victims of sex trafficking. And at the very last minute, that bill was killed. And so it's a very frustrating process when you're trying to do the right thing. And so I can get in there and I can make sure that we start putting our priorities in the right direction.
All right. And let's go ahead and delve into the issues. Probably one of the biggest hot button issues for folks where I'm talking to you from in Southwest Florida is going to be water quality. As I'm sure you know, we've been dealing with the blue-green algae blooms and also the toxic red tide algae blooms. We're getting some relief right now, but that had been an issue all summer long. And for the red tide, that had lingered for nearly a year. So what is your take on how we can address this in the future, hopefully preventing these kind of ecological and economic pain that we've experienced from that as the Commissioner of Agriculture?
Yeah, it's very heartbreaking. You're absolutely right. I spent a lot of time in your community. hearing the heartbreaking story of the businessmen and women who whose businesses have been suffering. You know, there was a $90 million hit this year on our tourism because of the green algae and the red tide. And so it has to be a priority, and it hasn't been under the current administration. We know that Governor Scott cut $700 million from the DEP budget. I would be a strong advocate to make sure that we put that money back in and we get the right regulations. And then we also know that there was a deregulation of the pollution, the pollutants up in the northern part of our state going into Lake Okeechobee. And we need to make sure that we are increasing our best management practices, that we are actually regulating them, which is not what's happening right now. And the other thing that's been so disappointing is that we haven't put science before politics. Politics has led the conversation. Everybody wants to finger point. But the reality is that, you know, when we saw the red tide exacerbated this year, it took everybody, you know, months upon months to start coming up with ideas and solutions. And that needs to be stopped. So we need to make sure that we're coming up with ideas. There's fantastic technology out there, innovative ideas of how to kill the red tide. And that wasn't initiated. And that needs to be done and become a priority. So as Commissioner of Agriculture, I would be a strong advocate of science, of technology, innovation. And there's a lot of people who want to help solve these issues and making sure that they have a seat at the table to start working through them and to make sure not only are we being proactive when we need to be, but, you know, reactive when the issue comes to us.
And I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about another one of your primary issues, and that's medical marijuana. I think it probably goes without saying that you're in agreement with recent rulings we've seen from Leon County Circuit Judge Charles Dodson, who's, you know, in no uncertain words, admonished both the legislature and the Department of Health for laws implementing that constitutional amendment passed by Florida voters, and then the Department of Health's regulatory activity regarding that. Tell me your take on this, because I know this is a big issue for you. Do you want the Department of Agriculture to play a bigger role in implementing medical marijuana here in Florida?
Yeah, you know, the ruling a couple weeks ago, you know, highlighted exactly what, you know, that we've been saying all along, that the legislature and the Department of Health has stood in the way of the proper implementation of this amendment. And I do firmly believe that the legislature is going to have to go back in during the 2019 session and fix all of this. So I do believe that the Department of Agriculture has a tremendous role to be playing in the future. One, because this is a crop. This is something that is being grown by our farming community, and we need to have a more active role. And especially once we start going towards the conversation of legalization, then it's absolutely just a crop like anything else that's being grown. And I think that, you know, the Department of Health has just been overloaded and bogged down with all of these rulemaking process, all of the lawsuits, all of the challenges. And it's time to start being proactive, get it out of the Department of Health. The Department of Agriculture already regulates so many different aspects, from the consumer services components, the growing aspects, to the fertilizers. And I think it's better served under the Department of Agriculture than the Department of Health. But what the rulings have been for the last couple of months has just, put it into writing what we have all been saying, that the legislature has violated the Constitution and their implementation is preventing access to our millions of patients across the state who are in dire need of this medicine.
That relates somewhat to another issue of yours. You really want Florida to embrace a hemp industry here. And I don't know about you, but if you had told me 20 years ago that the hemp industry in the United States was going to come after medical marijuana and in some places recreational marijuana, I never would have believed it, because all the issues that folks have had as far as mind-altering qualities of medical cannabis don't really have anything to do with hemp, and it's such a versatile product.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. It's kind of ludicrous. There's a history that goes along with this, that they were concerned that the cannabis crop, and so they didn't know how to decipher between hemp and cannabis and THC, so they just kind of lumped it all together. But I have been a huge proponent that we need to expand the hemp marketplace here in the state of Florida. Not only is it economically great for our farming community that has suffered tremendously from the citrus greening, from the tariffs, and from NAFTA, and so it gives them an alternative crop for growing, but it also is better for our environment. It uses less water, it uses less fertilizer, and we already are seeing so many of the CBD products coming into our state. I want to make sure that our farming community and our consumers here in the state of Florida are protected. Putting the CBD products through a regulatory framework here in our state so you know exactly what you're getting, and then be part of Fresh from Florida. So all of the economic benefits stay here and within our state. But this could be a fantastic crop that is a potentially it brings billions of dollars here to our state, which is taxable revenue that we could be using for affordable housing, for infrastructure, for education. And it's something that we need to be doing. And I have said that, you know, if I am elected, I will be working with the legislature during the first session, working on bills and language to actually accomplish this.
And while we're on the subject of something impacting growers, let's talk about citrus greening. We know science is close to, if not a solution, then a variety of workarounds for the citrus industry, you know, allowing trees infected with greening to live possibly for years. But thousands of growers have already called it quits. Thousands more are just living season to season trying to make it. What more could or should the Department of Agriculture be doing to help citrus growers and, you know, one of Florida's most iconic industries?
Yeah, we have to protect this industry. I mean, when people across the country think about Florida, they think about sunshine, beach, and citrus and our oranges. So we need to make sure that we are protecting our citrus industry. The University of Florida and IFAS has spent over $1 million in research. We need to make sure that we are continuing the research on this issue. And we have other, you know, I spoke to a young lady a couple weeks ago who's been working on another research project that focuses on the soil quality and making sure these types of different research aspects are funded and supported, and then giving our citrus growers the support that they may need if they want to try alternative growing processes. I've heard from some of our local farmers who are trying alternative grow process and are just haven't been receiving the support yet from the Department of Agriculture.
Well, and I want to switch gears a little bit to firearms as well. You know, as we know, earlier this year, the Department of Agriculture here in Florida came under fire after an Office of Inspector General investigation found that for more than a year, a staffer failed to run firearm applicants through an FBI database called the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. This ultimately resulted in the revocation of 291 firearm permits. How would the Department of Ag function differently under your leadership when it comes to enforcement of firearm regulations and determining who's going to, you know, have their applications approved and who won't?
Yeah, you know, first and foremost, you know, we need to do an audit of the department and figure out exactly what happened, why that we put that this was somebody was able to not log in for 13 months, whether that could happen again. We need to make sure that those holes are plugged, and also start the conversation of moving it over to back over to law enforcement. Law enforcement is already so instrumental in the process. And that way you get politics out of this. You know, we saw after the primary that over 300 emails were released between the Department of Agriculture and the NRA lobbyist, where she had direct influence over policies that were coming out of the Department of Agriculture. And when you move it over to law enforcement, you take the politics out of the conversation and make sure that background checks were done in an expedient and effective manner and not putting the risk in the lives of our Floridians in harm's way.
And on the consumer protection end of the department, you've had some tough talk on the campaign trail in the last couple months when it comes to cracking down on scammers and fraudsters, particularly gas station skimmers and phone scams. Tell me more about your position there and maybe where you see the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services not doing as much as it could.
Yeah, the balls have been dropped here, for sure. We have to reprioritize that. This is a huge part of this position. Is the consumer services and protecting our taxpayers across our state. And this hasn't been done. I've heard from, you know, tens of thousands of Floridians across our state that every time they call the Department of Agriculture to phone in a complaint of fraud that's happening, there's no response. There's no one on the other end. So we have to first be responsive to our citizens, and then we have to start investigating and going after these fraudsters and using resources from our local government. I know so many of our local governments want to be involved in these conversations so that they can use their resources at the local level, and that we need to have partnerships. And so I would heighten a lot of the influence that the local governments may have on this issue. I would also make sure that we are working on consumer protections if we need to beef up that stuff in the Florida statutes. I would be a proponent of that and start going after the bad guys. We have not seen that happen in the state, and so we need to make sure we prioritize the consumer services aspect of this job.
And a final question for you, because I haven't seen any other candidates making this a campaign issue the way you have. Food deserts. And I know it's certainly something that we've covered in our area and really public health officials in places where folks don't have access to traditional grocery stores. It's really been characterized as something of a public health crisis. Why has you made this such an important issue for you?
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. I've talked to so many people across the state that are living in food deserts, and to hear about the fact that, you know, when our children are walking home from school, or, you know, individuals that are working two or three jobs and have to go take, you know, bus after bus in order to get to the grocery store. And it is a crisis. It's a health conscious crisis because people are not getting, you know, produce. They're having to have canned food or frozen food or, you know, processed. And it creates a health crisis across our state. And it is a responsibility of the Department of Agriculture to step up and to be leaders in this, and to be working with our farming community, working with our local communities to create local communities of farmer markets and farms, and working with our box stores to create some type of working relationship in these communities, because this is a part of our state that has been completely neglected, and it definitely would be a priority in my office to make sure that we are coming up with new solutions to fix this, because otherwise people's health and safety are at risk. We're seeing an increase in diabetes and other types of health conditions that only increase our health insurance. And we have a moral obligation to step up and to fix this.
Well, Nikki Fried, I know your schedule is tight and I don't want to keep you any longer here, but I just wanted to say if there's anything else that you wanted to add or anything I should have asked that I didn't.
No, I just really appreciate your time. And I think the most important, you know, what I've been saying a lot on the campaign trail is 99.9% of things that fall underneath the Department of Agriculture are not partisan. We all drink the same water. We all breathe the same air. We all live on the same land. And the issues that are facing our state need to put, you know, science before politics. And, you know, really encourage everybody that realizes that you are looking for the best person for this job, and that this is not a partisan issue. While we may have letters next to our name that indicate a specific party, you need to be voting for the person, not the party.
Well, Nikki Fried, a candidate for Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, thanks so much for taking the time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That was a conversation with Democratic candidate for Florida Commissioner of Agriculture and Consumer Services, Nikki Fried, recorded late last week. Earlier this month, I sat down in studio with her Republican opponent, Matt Caldwell, for a closer look at his priorities and positions. You can hear that conversation online at GulfCoastLive.org. We're taking a short break, but when we return, last night, the PBS NewsHour's Judy Woodruff anchored an hour of special coverage from Florida, exploring how recent events are weighing on the minds of voters here. We're going to listen to several of those segments, including a conversation about President Trump's strategy in the Sunshine State and whether Red Tide might be turning some Republican voters blue. I'm John Davis. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm Julie Glenn. For the rest of the hour, we're going to highlight several segments from last night's PBS NewsHour, which spent the hour in Florida for special coverage in the lead-up to the general election. First up, Judy Woodruff hosts a special edition of Politics Monday with NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith and University of South Florida political science professor Susan McManus.
And now for a special edition of Politics Monday, I'm joined here in Tampa by NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith and Susan McManus, who is a longtime political analyst in this state. It's great to have you both here with me.
Great to be here.
Tam, so you've been looking at the national map in this election season, but put Florida in context. Why does this state matter so much?
I can tell you it does matter so much because it's not just about 2018, it's also about 2020. And there's this very competitive governor's race that matters a lot to President Trump, because who the governor of Florida is in 2020 will matter for that election. Of course, there's also this very competitive Senate race and a number of competitive House races as well, because Florida is this battleground.
It's a battleground, Susan McManus, and as you know from watching elections here, it's a state where elections are close. Tell us about that.
The last four big elections, two governor's races and two presidential, the margin of victory has just been 1%. There's no other state that is that competitive.
And you were telling me this morning the changing demographics, the makeup of the voting electorate here is what's making the outcome here uncertain.
Definitely. So many people still think of Florida as a retiree-only state. But the real news this election cycle is the rise of the younger electorate. Fully 52% of our current registered voters are from the three youngest generations. That would be Generation X, the millennials, and Generation Z. They're not particularly interested in registering with either party. There are a lot of them registering as no party affiliation. And they are just up for grabs. They're very energized by someone who can talk to them about their issues and communicate and inspire. I like to say they're looking for new faces in high places, and they're kind of a wild card. If they show up, one candidate's going to win. If they don't, the other. That's how much clout they have this election cycle.
And much more diverse than the older generations.
Yeah, the older generations are largely white. The younger generations, largely minority. In fact, the youngest generation is a majority non-white.
Tamara, President Trump is a factor in this election, no doubt about it. He's coming here, but you and I were just talking about the really divided messages they're sending.
Right. So President Trump has two more rallies here between now and Election Day. He has one in Fort Myers and one in Pensacola. The congressional districts he's going to are not in play. These are solid red Republican districts where he is going to go hold a typical Trump rally that is designed to fire up the base, where he talks about the caravan and he talks about how terrible Democrats are. Then you have the Trump campaign announcing today, releasing this ad that it's going to run. President Trump isn't in the ad at all. And the ad is really aimed at these suburban white women who have become a central focus of the midterms. And, you know, it's soft focus and there's a woman with her family. And President Trump is simply not present in those ads. Meanwhile, at his rallies, he's saying, I'm on the ballot. Even if I'm not on the ballot, I'm on the ballot. Vote for me.
We heard the voters that I interviewed Susan earlier saying that the president is, people have strong feelings about him one way or another. How much of a factor do you think he is?
He's in practically every ad, maybe not that one, but everyone knows that this is sort of a referendum on the president. It's hardened Republican support for him, some who are wavering, and it's certainly hardened Democratic opposition to him. He is clearly a big factor. And his favorability is a little bit higher than this state than in some other places. So surely his last-minute appearances are designed to turn out the base, but particularly in Fort Myers, because that's an area where the environmental issues have been so bad that some of the Republicans voted for his opponent in the primary. So he's got to pull those people back on board.
As we get closer to Election Day, of course, so much of the news, so much of our attention is focused on these terrible events of the last several days, Tam, the horrible shooting at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. Before that, the pipe bomb. There was a shooting at a grocery store in Kentucky against two black Americans. As you talk to voters in the state and to candidates, how much of that division is showing up?
The division is absolutely there. Voters, basically, Democrats think that there is something wrong with Republicans, and Republicans think that there is something wrong with Democrats. It is not just about policy anymore. It's very personal in the way that our politics have gone. You know, usually after an election, you move on. 2016 isn't over yet. Those fights are still being fought.
And Susan, again, you and I were having a conversation about how, for all the criticism of President Trump, the reaction, even to these terrible crimes, hate crimes, is divided here.
It is very divided. And I think what I'm hearing from a lot of people I've spoken to is a sadness about the direction the country's in, and it's worrisome. And it is true that each side sees the other as more vitriolic than their own. But everyone, I think, is just grasping for some kind of reality and some kind of civility in politics. What we're watching here is this turn of events, this heavily violent way we're going to keep some voters from voting at all? We don't know that. Or will it energize? But I think overall, I just hear the word, I'm really sad about America's direction.
One thing that I'm going to be looking for in the next few days is, how does this affect the president's approval rating? The president's approval rating is often very much tied to midterm outcomes. His approval had been ticking up. But in the past, after events like Charlottesville last year, his approval took a real hit. And it's not clear whether his response to these events, where he has said that anti-Semitism is wrong and needs to be condemned, then at the same time going to a rally and saying Hillary Clinton's name in a way and the crowd starts chanting "lock her up," is he going to be rewarded or punished by voters for that?
And even today, we've had a shooting into a Republican headquarters over in Volusia County. It just doesn't stop. It's so troubling to Americans.
It's certainly cast a shadow as we get close to this election day. Tamara Keith, Susan McManus, thank you both so much.
That was PBS NewsHour host Judy Woodruff speaking with NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith and University of South Florida political science professor Susan McManus during last night's special coverage from Florida. Next, from rising sea levels to toxic algae, Florida voters have a host of water problems on their minds this election season. Governor and Republican Senate candidate Rick Scott saw his poll numbers slide as red tide algae bloomed. Scott's critics blame him for cuts to environmental programs. His supporters say a Scott win may mean more help from the Trump administration. Next, we'll hear a report from Venice from Lisa Desjardins from PBS NewsHour's special coverage in Florida.
Rob Merlino spends as much time as he can on the water here in Venice, near Sarasota, on Florida's west coast. A self-employed marketer, he likes to say the pier is his home office.
Oh, I got something.
In recent months, though, he was forced off the water. This piece of paradise where he moved to enjoy life has been plagued by environmental problems. He showed us the water today.
This is not what it would look like normally. It would be more of a bright green when it's churned up with the sand. This is bad.
And his pictures of it last year.
See how turquoise it is? That's what it should look like.
In Florida, a host of water problems are rising as election issues. The toxic red tide algae spread from the Gulf Coast to Miami, burning beachgoers' eyes and lungs and killing fish, dolphins, sea turtles, and manatees by the dozens.
You can see the green algae.
PBS NewsHour reported on this crisis earlier this fall. In other areas of the state, Lake Okeechobee and on the Atlantic coast, slimy, rancid blooms of blue-green algae spurred health warnings. And in South Florida, there are rising concerns about rising sea levels and climate change.
And this year, the environment has become a political force, especially in Florida's U.S. Senate race. The Republican candidate, Governor Rick Scott, saw his polling numbers go south as red tide algae bloomed.
Scott's opponents point out he cut budgets for environmental programs and that under his administration, state workers were told not to use the term climate change. This is why Scott lost Libertarian and usually Republican voting Merlino, who can't believe he's heading toward a vote for Democratic incumbent Bill Nelson.
I know I'm not going to vote for Rick Scott. Bill Nelson is woefully ineffective as a senator. Rick Scott has been overtly harmful as a governor. So I will choose woefully ineffective over overtly harmful every day.
We want to make sure that people know whatever goes in that drain is going to end up in the Gulf.
Issues that motivated families on Saturday morning, labeling storm drains to try and prevent chemical dumping, which feeds algae blooms and exacerbates red tide.
Water is probably the most important issue.
Tampa real estate agent and lifelong resident, Republican Deb Tamargo, has built her life around the water and the outdoors. She believes Rick Scott will help, pointing to his leadership during recent hurricanes, saying he only cut environmental funding during lean years and has increased it recently. She believes voting a straight Republican ticket would mean more help from Washington and the Trump administration at a pivotal time.
We have a rare opportunity to elect Ron DeSantis as our governor, Rick Scott as our senator. As long as Donald Trump is in the White House, this is a trifecta for the environment. This is a win for the environment.
Clean water!
Meantime, some Floridians are organizing and rallying in reaction to the growing algae problems. Democrat Nadine Maricki is part of a nonpartisan group, Hands Along the Water.
Do you think the environment could swing this election?
Absolutely. The people that I've talked to in these all these groups that I'm with for clean water, I'm talking to longtime Republicans, and they're voting Democrat because of water. We're not going red or blue or purple or green. We're going water.
These roadside rallies got smaller after red tide subsided a few weeks ago. But the winds off the Gulf Coast are shifting back, again pushing red tide waters toward what usually are some of the most beautiful beaches in the world, and potentially again shifting the political tides in a major election year. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins in Venice, Florida.
That was Lisa Desjardins from PBS NewsHour's special coverage in Florida. Next, in the last two governors and presidential races, the winners in the state have been determined by razor-thin margins. This year, the results could hinge on the participation, or lack thereof, of three groups: retirees, young voters, and an influx of Puerto Ricans. Yamiche Alcindor reports on turnout efforts.
Señor Luis, ¿cómo está? Mucho gusto.
Turnout, turnout, turnout. That's the name of the game in Florida. Up and down the state, candidates and canvassers are working to get out the vote. That's because in the last two governors and presidential races, the winners in this state have been determined by razor-thin margins. And as a result, Democrats are trying to turn out two important groups that they hope will make the difference.
Florida is the classic referendum linchpin state in the country. It's almost perfectly divided in terms of its registration between Republicans, Democrats, and independents, which in Florida is a growing segment of the electorate.
Fernand Amandi is a Democratic pollster based in Miami.
It's all about the base here. So the base matters, and turnout is what drives the base. So if the base is not turning out, somebody's going to lose, and that's why in Florida it's paramount.
One key group, Puerto Rican voters, especially those newly arrived since Hurricane Maria hit the island last September. Frederick Velez is an organizer with Alianza. The group has spent months sending out mailers and registering people to vote. Now it's focused on making sure people show up.
We've had over 26,000 conversations with people who are either Puerto Rican or who are Latino, and those conversations are based and focused on why it's important to vote.
Does this feel like home?
Sometimes.
47-year-old Yvette Alcina understands the value of voting. In June, the mother of three moved from Puerto Rico to this neighborhood outside Kissimmee with her sons and grandson.
I left my family, my house, my friends, my culture. Everything's there, better.
Cilantro.
And like many Puerto Ricans, she was very disappointed by the Trump administration's response to Hurricane Maria last September.
There was not a lot of help for us. There's still people suffering over there. There's people over there, the houses, they don't have a roof. And FEMA, they went there. But they didn't help a lot.
The government of Puerto Rico says as a result of the storm, nearly 3,000 people died. President Trump has rejected that number. He claims Democrats inflated the death toll. Alcina was especially offended by this video of President Trump throwing paper towels to hurricane survivors. It was on her mind when she voted early last week for Democrats. She hopes they'll serve as a check on the president.
That's why yesterday I went to vote, because I want my dignity and respect back. We don't need paper towels. We need food. We want to help to build our houses again.
No one really knows how many Puerto Ricans have moved to Florida since Hurricane Maria. Estimates range from a high of 300,000 down to 50,000. But pollster Fernand Amandi says even tens of thousands could still prove pivotal.
25,000 votes could very well decide who wins Florida. So it could very well be that these Puerto Rican voters, if 15 or 20,000 of them enter the electorate and uniformly go from one side to the other, could be determinative.
Young voters are another group to watch. They typically don't vote in high numbers, especially during midterm elections. This year, though, organizers are working hard to change that.
Hey, guys, remember to vote.
On Saturday, volunteers with NextGen canvassed in North Miami Beach.
What issues do you care about?
The Democratic Political Action Group is funded by billionaire hedge fund investor Tom Steyer. It's been registering young people to vote across Florida, including at high schools and colleges, in the wake of the school shooting in Parkland. Meanwhile, at a Get Out the Vote event in Liberty City, Miami, young people gathered to talk politics over food, football, and music. It was sponsored by Dream Defenders, a group started in 2012 after the killing of Trayvon Martin. Rodnika Cockcroft, an organizer, said 2016 was a wake-up call for many.
Our generation is starting to step into their power because we realize that those 70, 75-year-old people who've been in power for 30 years are fixated in the mentality that they have already, and it doesn't align with ours. When they're gone, we're going to be stuck with the issues that they left us with.
Dream Defenders ran shuttles to the polls nearby. Early voting began last week.
We're saying if you repeal that, people are now able to be prosecuted.
Along the way, organizers tried to explain Florida's 12 amendments on the ballot this year.
I think that the potential for young people to make a difference in the midterm election is definitely there. At the same time, I think that the Democratic candidates need to give young people something to vote for.
Sometimes people are receptive to what we have to say. Sometimes they're not.
Marcus Horton is a 28-year-old Navy vet who just graduated from Florida International University. Horton does not identify as a Republican or a Democrat, but often votes with Democrats. He's supporting Democrat Andrew Gillum for governor. The most important issues to him? Restoring voting rights for felons, health insurance, which he doesn't have, and the impact of student loans.
That means that when we graduate from college, we can't start businesses. We have too much debt. It means that we can't buy homes. And so we're kind of finding ourselves in this position where we are limited in the choices that we can make. That could be a very powerful platform position. There's enough young people now to more young people than older people.
Still, Horton isn't sure that young people will make the difference this year.
I do see a lot more people who are politically engaged and they seem to care about this. But at the same time, you know, you can walk somewhere and you not hear anything about it at all. And so that's a little scary.
Despite the energy surrounding young and Puerto Rican voters, experts warn not to forget about another population.
Glad to have you here.
Senior citizens are a reliable voting bloc that leans Republican. We met one of them, Gary Sisler, at the East Ridge Retirement Community in South Miami.
I tell young people, try to find a passion in life.
He's an 84-year-old former Exxon employee who spent years living abroad before moving to Miami. Sisler thinks people who disagree aren't talking to each other enough.
In my case, I have two college-educated daughters. I know they're both liberal. We can't talk politics. And I've overheard them say to my 10-year-old grandson, don't discuss politics with grandpop. That hurts. Now we've got weights that we use.
Among the issues he's concerned about, immigration.
I think that we are bringing in far too many unskilled people, uneducated people that don't speak any English. That creates a social obligation on our part.
He's also worried about the federal debt.
Both sides seem to be scared to death to even discuss it. I blame both sides equally. Come on, get off your fanny. This is an issue.
In 2016, Sisler started a monthly political discussion group called Jib Jab. He introduced us to a few of his friends, all Republicans who strongly support President Trump.
He has reached out to groups of people who were forgotten before. This president has restored faith in a lot of those people.
Immigration is a big problem right now. This bothers me.
The Puerto Ricans, they automatically can vote coming in. I'm kind of bothered by that.
What do you think of Democrats looking at young people and people of color as the way to get this blue wave in Florida?
I don't like it, but to me, that's what's happening.
Three groups, retirees, young voters, and an influx of Puerto Ricans, all could have a major impact on election night, just 1 week away.
That was PBS NewsHour reporter Yamiche Alcindor reporting on turnout efforts in Florida. We've been highlighting several stories from last night's special episode hosted from Florida as the general election approaches. You can find links to all of these stories and the rest of last night's NewsHour at GulfCoastLive.org. That's all the time we have for today's show, but I want to thank our earlier guests, Tallahassee Mayor and Democratic candidate for Florida Governor Andrew Gillum, and Nikki Fried, the Democratic candidate for Florida Commissioner of Agriculture. If you'd like to hear John Davis's interview with her opponent, Republican Matt Caldwell, just go to GulfCoastLive.org. We have invited Republican candidate for Governor Ron DeSantis to be on the show, too, and that invitation remains open. Our show today was produced by Mike Canary, John Davis, and myself. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1. WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM. NPR for Southwest Florida.